So last week we finished Daniel 6, and as I mentioned last time, the first six chapters of Daniel are his life and background. And from 7 on, it gets into prophetic stuff. I think I said at the beginning of this, there are lots of people who try and convince you that Daniel is just fiction, that it didn't really happen. And one of the things that I think is going on here is that the things that happened to Daniel and his companions are by way of authenticating him, just as Elijah and Elisha and so forth were able to do signs and wonders, and that authenticated that they were connected to God. And I think the same thing is going on with Daniel. The other thing that's going on here, and we'll see this as we go along in the prophetic parts, is people say that Daniel was written sometime after the Maccabean revolt, because the history of what I call the soap opera, where, you know, the king of the north and the king of the south and exchanging women and all sorts of stuff, exactly matches the events leading from the time Alexander the Great died until the Maccabean rebellion. So people say, yeah, this is just fiction. Several problems with that, of course. The first one that I mentioned is Yeshua refers to Daniel as a prophet. So that's kind of an indicator to me. The other one is in the other prophets, God says if Noah, Daniel, and Job were in this city, they would only be able to save themselves. They wouldn't be able to save the city. So the idea of the other prophets regarding Daniel as a prophet and a righteous man. And the third one is Daniel tracks really well with Revelation. So if you believe John and you believe Revelation, the correlation between what Daniel sees in his dreams and the prophecies he's given with Revelation is so strong that there's no way that that could have been written before the book of John was written. What I'm saying is the scholarly opinion is Daniel was written in the 2nd century BC, after the events of the Maccabean Rebellion. But John in Revelation and Daniel in his visions match just like hand in glove. So in order for that to happen without Daniel being a prophet, then Daniel would have had to have been written in the late 1st century AD. That doesn't work, because even the scholars say, no, this is 2nd century stuff. So I am perfectly comfortable with Daniel having been written when it says it was written, at the time of Nebuchadnezzar and at the time of the end of the Babylonian Empire and so forth. So let's start, and I'm going to read the first 8 verses of chapter 7, and then I'm going to stop there and I'm going to come back and talk about it. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. I don't know who he told it to, but probably just to his diary. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, it had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, it had 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth, and was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful, and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. So that's the essence of his vision. First thing to notice is it's out of sequence, because in the narrative part of the book, Belshazzar departed the scene two chapters ago. So this is in the first year of Belshazzar is when he had his vision. So this is being read to us retroactively, if you will. And Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Okay, the great sea is the Mediterranean, obviously. And the four winds of heaven, you'll remember in Revelation 7, after this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on earth or sea or against any tree. Then I saw another ascending from the sun with the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had given power to harm earth and sea, saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of God on their forehead. And then we have the sealing of the 144,000. So the idea of these four winds, if you will, they have the ability to destroy. They have the ability to harm. Back to Daniel now, you have these four winds stirring up the great sea, the Mediterranean. So I'm suggesting to you that those four winds are the same four winds we're talking about in Revelation 7. Metaphorically in the Bible, the sea represents Gentile nations. The land represents Israel. So the whole idea here is these destructive winds are stirring up the Gentile nations, and out of the sea from the Gentile nations come these four beasts. Now, as I said when we were in Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue has got four sections to it as well. You have the head of gold, you have the chest over an arms of silver, you have the belly and thighs of bronze, and you have the legs and feet of iron. So you have the same image of four, if you will. And what I said then, I will say now again because it's correct, is what we're talking about is one thing, one statue, and that statue has four manifestations. So the first manifestation is the Empire of Babylon, and this was explained back when Daniel was explaining the dream, followed by the Medes and the Persians, followed by Greece under Alexander, finally followed by Rome, and of course it would eventually be destroyed by the rock that came out of the great mountain, and the rock, of course, is Yeshua, and he establishes his kingdom. So this presented to Nebuchadnezzar a vision of a magnificent statue that represented all of human history from him forward. Daniel is getting the same vision, except he's getting it from God's perspective. And where Nebuchadnezzar's perspective is, wow, look at these magnificent things that are created here, from God's perspective is dangerous animals, dangerous beasts. And from that alone, you get some idea of what God's opinion of human government is. As George Washington said, government is like fire. It is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. So our founding fathers, being students of the Bible, recognized the propensity of human government to get into a self-aggrandizing loop and oppress and turn people into slaves and so forth. So what we're seeing here in the Daniel, as I say, is God's opinion of these same four stages of empire as he gave to Nebuchadnezzar, but God's vision of it and Nebuchadnezzar's are completely different. So the four beasts come out sequentially. It is not the case that all four beasts come out of the sea abreast, like an invasion on a coast. They come out one at a time. And again, that indicates the time sequencing of these empires. So the first one, obviously, is Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. And we have Nebuchadnezzar's madness in there. Interestingly, if you look at some of the old stone friezes in the ruins of ancient Babylon, you see winged lions. It's one of the symbols of the empire, if you will. The second beast, which is like a bear, raised up on one side, it had three ribs in its mouth. between its teeth and was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." That, of course, is the Medes and the Persians. And the idea of it being raised up on one side is because one is going to be stronger than the other. This is the combination of two kingdoms, and the Persians are going to wind up being stronger and eventually will absorb the Medes. Initially, it's two, but it's on one side, indicating that one side's higher than the other, and eventually it will become one. The three ribs in its teeth, Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon, tried to resist the Medes and the Persians, and they were destroyed. Hence the idea of three ribs in its mouth. The bear is eating them. The former owners of the ribs are not going to survive, is the idea there. Verse 6, "And as I looked, behold, another, like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it." So that's the third empire. And of course, that's Greece under Alexander the Great. And one of the things that Alexander excelled at, he was obviously a military genius, his armies moved way faster than anybody thought could be done. The image of the bear earlier, this was ponderous and massive. So they would whip up an army of 2.5 million men and trudge across the Fertile Crescent. They were not especially fleet, and they were not especially nimble. They were massive. Whereas Alexander is quick, nimble, and, as I say, a military genius. And of course, you all know the story. Alexander himself dies somewhere around India, eastern Persia, western India, and he has four generals under him. His will is said, let the strongest take it. So he doesn't leave a chain of command. He doesn't leave a line of succession. He just dies. And so the four generals get together and divide up his empire among themselves. The two we're interested in are Seleucus and Ptolemy. Seleucus basically gets what is today Syria and the east all the way to India. Ptolemy gets Egypt. And what's going to happen is, of course, since you have Seleucus in the north in what's now Syria and east all the way to India, and Ptolemy in Egypt to the south, the bridge between them is Israel. So the two of them, over a period of a couple hundred years, slosh back and forth through Israel until finally we get to the time of Antiochus, who's a Seleucid, Antiochus Epiphany, the one who is to come. And it is under him that we get the Maccabean revolt. The commentary that Ken lent me, I was reading it today, he was saying it's interesting that the four wings are the wings of a bird, not the wings of an eagle, for example. Whereas the lion has eagle's wings, majestic animal and a majestic bird. Greece has just got bird wings, nothing special. Verse 7, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." Chuck Missler did a series on this, and he says, the name of the little horn ought to be Blabbermouth. And you'll see the same thing when we get to it in Revelation, because he speaks blasphemies and all sorts of stuff. Same image. And the idea here of 10, you had 10 toes on the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and you have, instead of iron toes mixed with clay, you now have iron teeth. So the metaphors are slightly shifted, but it's obviously the same thing. And one thing that I will say here as a preface, one of the things to notice is both in Nebuchadnezzar's dream and this one, the character of this last empire is different. And specifically, it devours and breaks in pieces and stomps on what is left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So the idea here is this is a completely different character of government than the imperial and regal governments that had preceded it. I'm thinking modern bureaucracies. And if you look at what's happening in Davos right now, where you have all of these wannabe world dictators hanging around each other, and they're all coming up with, oh yeah, we got to give everybody a passport so we'll know that they're vaccinated, and we got to reduce the population, and we got to do this. And they have these grandiose plans for what they're going to do with the whole world. That's very different than the kingdoms before, where you had Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar was a king, and he went out and conquered like kings do. But aside from getting tribute from everybody, he wasn't looking to micromanage all of his kingdom. Same thing with the Medes and the Persians, normal kingdom kind of stuff. And they certainly conquered a lot of land, and they conquered a lot of people, but mostly it was, make sure you ship us enough tribute, and we'll ensure peace in your region. Same thing with Alexander. Conquered a whole bunch of stuff. He was a young man and was full of young man's heat and just wanted to see how far he could conquer. And then when he died, his generals became regional kings. And it wasn't until Antiochus that you started to get this trying to get everybody on the same religious sheet and all that kind of stuff. Rome, for example, had a system of laws and civil order that they imposed on everybody. And that set of laws and civil order is the model for what the United States and Europe have set up over the century. And the whole idea is this bureaucratic mass that doesn't care about the people that it governs, it only cares about its own power. For example, if you look at Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia, internet meme, Hitler and Stalin didn't kill 100 million people. Their governments did. If you remember the Nuremberg trials, the standard defense was, I was just following orders. And that's what I'm calling this government of a different character that rises up at the end. And that's what we see is trying to happen at Davos with all of these so-called elites trying to figure out how they can get the whole world under their system with them in charge. Let's go on. Verse 9. And as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, and the wheels were burning fire. You remember when Ezekiel sees the Merkava, the chariot, it's got wheels on it. Daniel is seeing the same kind of thing. Verse 10, a stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I find that really interesting in light of what I was just saying about governments, because the Medes, the Persians, the Babylonians, and the Greeks have all faded away. Their empires are no more. Rome, of course, has faded away, but the Roman system has simply moved into Europe and the United States. So what I don't know is being said here is if that Roman system is going to be broken, but the ancient system of kings conquering each other and so forth is going to be maintained. That's what it seems to say, but I don't know that. Of course, the idea of the throne and so forth is God is going to judge the nations of the earth. And that judgment, at least right here, is going to be to take out what I'm describing as the Roman system, but leave the nations of the earth for a time. That's a guess based on not much. Verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And again, this is the rock that was cut from the mountain without hands. And you remember in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that rock hit where? It hit the feet. So the idea there that what I'm describing as this pseudo-Roman system is going to be what gets slammed first, and the nations of the world will continue to exist absent that system of government. All right, now let me freewheel a little here. This is speculation based on what I just said. And I'm freewheeling, and so if somebody says, wow, that's full of cornflakes, I would happily entertain discussion on that. This is not thus saith anybody but me. One of the things that's going to happen in Revelation is Yeshua is going to reign for 1,000 years. And what I'm suggesting is that that reign will be preceded by the destruction of the fourth beast. But the other three beasts are still going to exist. Because at the end of 1,000 years, Satan is going to be released. And Satan is going to again deceive the nations. And he's going to deceive them into attacking Yeshua. So that may be what's being said here in Daniel. But that's a guess on my part. But at the end of verse 14, what you basically have is Nebuchadnezzar's dream from a different perspective. Otherwise, the dream is the same. The comment was the streams of fire coming out from the throne. Was he seeing something like a helicopter, a gunship, or something like that? I don't know. That kind of thing becomes more obvious when we get to Revelation, where you've got the demon locusts that have stings in their tails and so forth, and they sound like a rushing wind, and lots of people have interpreted that as being modern mechanized warfare. I don't know whether the stream of fire that comes out of the Ancient of Days throne is part of that or not. It may simply be fire from heaven, which is also a biblical thing. Verse 15, as for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall rise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and forever. 19. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth and spoke great things, and that seemed greater than its companions. One other thing that occurs to me, this breaking apart and stomping on what's left kind of thing, that very much reminds me of Christian persecution. We're going to take everything that has anything to do with God, we're going to break it, and we're going to stomp it into the mud, which is very much what's going on at Davos, very much what's going on lots of places in the world. So I see this fourth beast as being, and Daniel does too. Daniel is absolutely terrified by that fourth beast, whereas the three previous kings, he's sort of, okay, fine, you know, history is history, and, you know, empires come and go. This one is different. And that's what's being emphasized here. Verse 21, as I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. The commentary that Ken gave me, and this guy's a rapture maven, he says that in context, the saints are Israel. Daniel's an Israelite. We haven't had Christianity yet. So the saints that we're talking about here is Israel. And all of this is happening after the rapture, when the world has got Satan and the Jews duking it out. That's how he sees this. I don't, but it's a very common perspective on this stuff. Verse 23. He said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it in pieces. Think Davos right now. They're looking to devour the whole earth. They're looking to establish a one-world government. That was one of the things that the United States has tried to do, oddly enough, where they are trying to establish a rules-based international order with things like international courts to settle wars and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't work very well. In fact, having done it, we refused to sign on to the international court. But anyway, think all that kind of stuff, the UN, Davos, etc. Verse 23, he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it in pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and wear out the saints of the Most High. He shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Stop there a minute. One of the things that is a perennial issue is the law and the times. Those are both central to what God has done. So God gave us the Torah, and he gave us a set of appointed times. And he gave us a calendar, and he gave us a way to figure things out. That has been under sustained attack ever since the time of Yeshua. So you have much of the Sunday church who disconnected the church from the Hebrew calendar. So Easter, instead of being after Passover, is now the first Sunday after first full moon in the vernal equinox or something like that. And they took 100 years to figure this out. How can we get Passover at about the right time without messing with the Jews? I mean, that was literally what they were doing. Said many times, I have heard Christian preachers say, stay out of that Old Testament, it doesn't apply to you. Don't want to be under that old law. So this whole idea that this mixture of God and paganism and this distrust and hatred of the Jews has resulted in changing the laws and the times. In fact, there was a committee. Brasilia is the capital of Brazil. It is a manufactured city. Some Brazilian Congress or whatever they have decided, we're going to make a new capital. They put it right in the middle of the Amazon. And it's theoretically the capital of the country, but nobody goes there because it's in the middle of the Amazon. And they had a big committee in there working to figure out how to get the world on a 10-day work week. So like the metric system, you know, everything's based on decade. Well, we ought to have a 10-day work week. And so this bureaucratic stuff that has arisen since Rome keeps trying to change God's laws and God's times. That's what I believe is being talked about here. And this time, times, and half a time, we will see that over and over again here in Revelation and so forth. That is typically regarded as 3.5 years. So time, times, time is 1 year, times is a dual, a time and a pair of times, and a half. So it comes up to 3.5 years. And we'll see that over and over again. 26, but the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away. to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve them. Do you have him in your translation? Are you in ESV? You have a newer version than I have. So read it again. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. And that, I am firmly convinced, is talking about the thousand-year reign. And for the rapture maven that wrote this commentary that I've been reading, he says, that's the Jews. Church is out of here. This is all the people of the Jews. 28. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Now, we've got about 20 minutes, and I'm going to do a fast trip through Revelation, and we're going to talk about beasts, and I want to show you the correlation between the two. So, let's start in Revelation 11. This is the two witnesses that witness in Jerusalem. So, coming down to 11:4. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. And by the way, that goes back to Zechariah. Remember, you have the olive tree with the pipes feeding the lamps. Same imagery. And if anyone would harm them, fire pours from their mouth and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, this is how he is doomed to be killed. They have the power to shut the sky, that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have the power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desire. So that's the two witnesses, and at least in my economy, that's Moses and Elijah. The things that they do are typical of those two prophets. But you want to do somebody else, or some people that want to have it be Enoch, whatever. I don't know, but that's what makes sense to me. So, verse 7. And when they have finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city that symbolically is called Sodom in Egypt, where the Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, there we have our 3.5 again. For 3.5 days, some from the peoples and tribes and languages and nations will gaze upon their dead bodies and refuse to let them be placed in a tomb. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry and exchange presents. And you say Christmas. Because these two prophets had been a torment to those who dwell on the earth. By the way, in Revelation, those who dwell on the earth is a phrase that you see over and over and over again. And that is as distinct from believers. So earth dwellers are the mass of humanity that are neither Christians or Jews. They're pagans or whatever. So for 3.5 days, some from the peoples and tribes and languages and nations will gaze on the dead bodies and so forth. Exchange presents, verse 11. But after 3.5 days, a breath of life from God entered them, and they stood up on their feet, and great fear fell on all them who saw him, I guess. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up into heaven in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. And a great earthquake and so forth. So I regard that as constructive notice. God saying, time to come to Jesus, and this is your last call. That's what I regard that as. So the next one is in Revelation 13. I saw a beast coming out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads. Notice we have 10 and 7. In Daniel's vision, it was 10 horns, and then one horn came up and displaced 3 horns. So this idea of 10 and 7, or 10 and 3, or however you want to look at it, is still there. And blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. So you have elements of all of Daniel's dream there. This beast rising out of the sea, and notice it comes out of the sea just like Daniel's beasts came out of the sea. So it's among the nations in that sense. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon, for he had given authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who can fight against him? And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. 3.5 years again. The times are all the same, and you have this blabbermouth, if you will, who is just like the little horn in Daniel. All I'm doing is just taking you through very quickly and pointing out the similarities in imagery and so forth. Verse 6. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war with the saints to conquer them. And authority was given over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with a sword, then with the sword he must be slain. Here's a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Now, if you're a rapture maven, the saints here are Jews. If you're not a rapture maven, the saints are all believers. One of the things I find interesting is you have a combination of Calvinism and free will here. First one, it's all who dwell on the earth will worship everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb. So that indicates predestination. Boy, if you were written for the foundation of the world, you're going to be okay. If not, then crispy critters for you. But then we get down to the end of verse 10. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Well, wait a minute. Which is it? We have to persevere and work our way through this, or can we sit on our blessed assurance and not worry about it? Lots of the Bible is that way. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. In this commentary that I just read, the first beast rising out of the sea is coming from the nations. It gets its power from the dragon, from Satan. According to him, the second beast rising out of the earth is a Jew, and he will be the false prophet. Don't know if that's correct or not, it's just what that particular commentary said. And I agree with the symbolism out of the sea being from the nations, and I understand what he's saying about out of the earth. And it has two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. And you could see how that symbolism would match a Jew. Is a Jew just like Yeshua was, two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. You know, there's a false prophet. 12. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of the people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceived those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image of the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. If you notice, going back to Nebuchadnezzar, when he put up his statue, the deal was, if you don't fall down and worship the statue, it's into the fiery furnace for you. So you have, going back to Nebuchadnezzar here, if you won't fall down and worship the image of the beast here, you will be killed. So very similar, if you will, to what's going on in Daniel. 16. And it also causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and its number is 666. By the way, notice that one thing we have not mentioned in everything I've said tonight is the Antichrist. The Antichrist does not appear in Revelation. The Antichrist only appears in the letters of John, And the Antichrist in the letters of John is a false teacher. He's not a ruler. So you read all sorts of stuff in Christian literature about this being the Antichrist. No, it's a beast. It's a government, human government. So we're in 14 now, and we got messages from three angels. The second angel appeared saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of sexual immorality." And another third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on its forehead or on its hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, those worshipers of the beast and his image, whoever received the mark of his name." Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Yeshua. The whole point of this warning is so that you won't fall into that trap. And then we have the seven angels with the seven plagues in chapter 15. Pick it up at the beginning. "And I saw seven signs in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, for with them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name standing beside the sea of glass. With harps of gold in their hands, they sang the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb." This is mirroring Exodus, where they cross the sea and they come up on the far side and they sing. So then, chapter 16, and this is the angels pouring out their bowls of wrath. "So the first angel went and poured out the bowl on the earth, and harmful, painful sores came upon the people who bore the mark of the beast and worshipped his image." This mirrors Exodus, where you have boils on everybody. We talked about that on Shabbat. Down to verse 10, "The fifth angel poured out its bowl on the throne of the beast." So this is government center. "The angel poured out its bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. People gnawed their tongues in anguish and cursed the God of heaven for their pain and sores. They did not repent of their deeds." This is the earth dwellers. Again, you have a plague of darkness, just like Egypt. Verse 12, "The sixth angel poured out its bowl on the great river, Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the ways for the kings of the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophets," all three now, dragon, beast, false prophets, "three unclean spirits like frogs." Notice you have frogs coming out of a river, just like Exodus. And then down to chapter 17, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers of the earth have become drunk.' And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. So the whole point is Babylon, with its pagan system of worship, which is, among other things, centered around sex and centered around commerce and money, is allied and rides the beast. So this beast, that is system of Babylon, which has gone around the world, and I said on Shabbat, for those of you who are here, the gods of Babylon and the gods of Greece and the gods of Rome and the gods of, you name it, going west, are all the same personalities, they just have different names. The name changes, but the personalities don't. And the whole point there is this Babylonian system follows secular power. So when Babylon was the center of power, the gods were in Babylon. Go to Media and Persia, there they go. Then we go to Greece, and the gods are Greek. Then we go to Rome, and the gods become Rome. The god Zeus from Greece becomes Jupiter and Rome. So the whole point here is this whore, the Babylonian system, is riding human government. And then coming down to verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand the golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written the name of mystery, Babylon, the great mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Yeshua. When I saw her, I marveled greatly, but the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers of the earth, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. So we're not going to finish the chapter, but the point is, beasts, both in Daniel and in Revelation, represent human government, with one exception. And the one exception is Satan himself, who is described as a dragon, which is also a beast. But when you read beasts in all of this, think human government. Certainly they have supernatural power. They all, especially the fourth beast, want to bring all details of human life under its control. So where Nebuchadnezzar was perfectly happy just to conquer people and then take tribute, and you go off and do whatever you want to do, but just make sure I get my tribute and make sure that you don't rebel. Wasn't interested much in organizing the daily life of anybody. That wasn't his thing. But when you get to the tenth beast, that tenth beast wants to be involved in every detail of your life. It wants to dictate vaccinations. It wants to dictate where you go to school. It wants to dictate where you work. It wants to dictate how you spend your money. Banks right now are tracking your purchases so that they can figure out who's not worthy of having money. That is the fourth beast, this all-encompassing, crushing human government system, whether you call it communism, fascism, Republican democracy, whatever you call it, it's all the same, and it always has the same tendencies.